Welcome, everyone, back to episode 13 of To the Unknown Pod. It is great to have you here. My name is Jordan Bush. I am the executive director of TGFB Media, which exists to help Christians understand and use Bitcoin for the glory of God and the good of people everywhere. I am joined by the Mountain Presbies, we should call them, plus Osh. I don't know what we call him. But basically, we are here. Why don't you guys introduce yourself?
I'm the Portland Baptist.
That's right.
Represent.
Name yourself.
That's it. Michael Hawthorne, okay. Out here at Brilliance Labs, an innovation incubator for kingdom startups and Bitcoin. And we take fun ideas and try to do stuff with them.
I'm Tim Fox, executive director of the Magnolia Foundation. We're working at Orange Pill Churches. I'm also a Presbyterian minister.
I'm Jim. I'm tech support.
Love it. Jim McAndrew, entrepreneur, PCA deacon.
Just tech support.
DOD Jim, vibe coder extraordinaire. Listen.
Google acolyte.
Google lover. Yeah, man. So today's episode, for those of you who've never seen this before, what are we doing here? Again, what we do is we spend time on Twitter every week. And so we, as Christians, want to be good stewards. So we want to steward and redeem our time on Twitter. And so what we do is we set aside, as we're, you know, scouring through the Twitter webs, the interwebs, we basically just find things that either encourage us as husbands, as fathers, as men, as Bitcoiners, et cetera, et cetera. And then we just basically say, hey, well, let's just put this aside. I'd love to get Oshawa's take on this. I'd love to get Tim's take on this. Jim's take. Would love to hear what these guys think. And so we just kind of talk around. We talk about issues and these different kind of different tweets, and then we march on forward. Today, episode 13, we don't believe in luck. We're going to make this. We make luck good. So we're here for episode 13. We're not afraid of the number. And although maybe that is pretty fitting, episode today, breaking the internet. What in the world is going on in the world? Nobody's websites are working. Guys, what are our thoughts?
Well, shout out to our homie Marty for that title.
That's right. We totally
stole it from him.
Shamelessly stolen. We did feel a little bit of shame, I won't lie. Borrowed. We'll give it back.
It was kind of a big bummer. DroneLink runs on Google. It was down for at least an hour.
Jim, what's DroneLink?
DroneLink is another company I do tech support for. So.
Fantastic.
It's a drone software automation startup that doesn't do any work with the Department of Defense.
Love it.
So is it kind of like if I had my autonomous drone flying around and Google went down, did my drone just crash?
Yeah, they just all self-destructed all at once.
It's just like, fall into the ocean. I'm like getting a surf shot.
No, just like unfortunately, crashing. That would have been cool, but all it meant was people couldn't pay me, sadly. So it was bad for me, but good for people that had already paid me and were flying their drones.
Okay.
Glorious. Yeah. Well, guys, speaking of the internet being down, for some reason, my phone, having all of our links on it, is not wanting to connect.
So, what did I tell you? I said, check the thing before.
No, that has nothing to do with it. It all disappeared. It was here, and now it's disappeared. This is glorious.
Jim, take over, please. Take the wheel.
Breaking the internet. I will be feeding you systematically the links via
you're going to share that on my screen?
An out-of-bounds Bitcoin link, Twitter link transaction I will be sending to you, much to the chagrin of all the ocean guys. We're going to be doing this, so yes.
We think you have tech support here.
Before we started, we told Jordan, just let Jim do it. And he was absolutely convinced that he needed to share.
Maybe we should actually have a vote. Anybody that's watching, vote. Should we post these to a shared Google sheet that just kind of works?
Should we
post them Google. To like a
Google
Twitter out community something or Twitter private data. Something? Okay.
We renounce Google and all its works.
Hey, Google Sheets actually remained up during the internet breakdowns. So
that's what they want you to think. That's all just
look, we're
Iran and right. Taking over your Google sheet.
East India Trading Company like ruled the entire world through spreadsheets, man.
Actually, Tim, here's a question for you. Are you using your never mind.
Okay, yeah, Jim.
Jim, take the wheel.
Take the wheel.
Okay. Where are you sending them to me? On Carrier Pigeon or?
That's right. Carrier Pigeon. That's exactly where they're going.
Use your spreadsheet. You got some great stuff.
I used to use my spreadsheet.
Plop them in my spreadsheet.
That's not going to happen, Jim. Just grab the ones you've got.
I'll grab mine because they're in the spreadsheet.
That's right. Grab them. You send them up and then I'll get you the rest of them.
Okay. Here we go.
All right. Let's see. All right. First up, this is a little old, but Elon regrets some of his posts that he made about Donald Trump. Jordan, we did an episode last week about the Elon Trump beef.
Correct. I mean, this is, listen, apparently Trump isn't capable of apologizing, but at least Elon can. This is, I mean, listen, that's good. I'll take a win.
Yeah.
So, but some of the posts, which ones? Is he regret the one where he said he's on the Epstein list? Or that he loves him as much as a straight man can love another man? Because
I'm pretty sure he's referring to his deleted post, which is the Epstein post.
Oh my gosh.
I just don't understand. I don't think these posts should have ever been posted in the first place. Like, I don't.
That's a hot take, Jim. That's a hot one. I think there's lots of people who are thrilled by them.
The posts?
Oh yeah, they loved them. The left leaners, they were big fans.
Yeah, I don't know if that's just Elon and Elon being an autist or if it's just like everybody does that nowadays.
Yep.
Do you guys have posts that you regret?
I've been known to delete a tweet or two. Okay.
I made it as
Jordan's trademark.
That I felt
this message was deleted. TM Jordan Bush.
Listen, just because I'm sensitive to this to the ghost and some of us aren't, that doesn't mean that, you know, it wasn't a wise move. All right. I'm just saying.
Tim, have you ever deleted a post?
Yeah, I just did, but
let's go.
Put it in the wrong spot. And I had to redo it. I'm a boomer.
Jim, can you scroll down and find the Peter Schiff comment in response to the Musk?
Oh my gosh. Absolutely unhinged.
Could you find it's absolutely hilarious. It's in our signal chat.
Needs
too.
To go back and read the book of Proverbs.
That's right.
Slow way down with blasting out your thoughts on everything.
It's true.
Yes. So while you look for it, Peter Schiff basically said, even the best of us regret posting things occasionally.
Yeah. Gosh, why is that funny? Why is that funny? Please explain for those who aren't serially on Twitter.
Oh, my word. Well, because just a week prior, he apparently came to the defense of a pedophile by saying, hey, all of us have had relations with underage girls. That's what I did in college.
Yeah. Just out of nowhere, comes out of left field and says that. And then people are like, what?
What in the world are you talking about? So, yeah, and he, of course, had to backtrack that because it is not socially acceptable, nor morally, nor in any other respect, too.
Yeah, here's his take back. This looks like it was definitely written by his handlers.
Yeah. Yeah, it's like it's a whole deal. We don't need to go and talk about that. But, all right, Jim, are you getting these other links that I'm sending you?
Well, I am, but you're sending them to a place that I don't have access to right now.
You don't have access to my phone. On your computer?
Is Signal on the computer?
Yeah, it is.
Hey.
Okay.
Well, these guys tried to get their act together. Tim, talk to us about controlling our tongues. What wisdom
do you have for us, the
keyboard warriors who are among us and listening?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, it's like lots of technology. Social media enables all kinds of great things, but the ability to just immediately barf out whatever you're thinking and the way that it encourages that, I think, is generally bad for people and bad for their relationships. And yeah, I don't know. You know, this whole wisdom principle of being quick to listen and slow to speak, just in our world, it's lost quickly. I mean, it's like you're out of date in like a day. So I don't know. I mean, I have a personal principle of when I'm sending a real heavy email, sleep on it, send it the next day. And I've radically revised many emails that way. And I would have said things I really regretted. But I don't know, tweeting and texting and stuff is not, it's so much easier to send them compared to an email. You know, it's easy to sleep on an email, but you're crazy if you don't respond to text messages. When I moved back to the States from Scotland, I had and I continue to have a hard time adjusting to the fact that people expect you to respond to their text messages pretty quickly. I got really used to it in Scotland of like, oh, no one replies to anything. This is great. No one expects you to respond. So still working on it 10 years later.
Can we all just, can we just make Scotland, the U.S. Scotland again? Can we just do that? We were all, half of us were over there before. So it's, all right, Tim, this is one of the ones you shared. So why don't you just continue giving us wisdom?
Yeah, this is Neil Shenvey. He's a Christian apologist type guy. I don't know. This reminded me of stuff that sometimes you see this in Bitcoin world. Craving elite respectability is a very real temptation. And so is craving the approval of fellow dissidents and friends in the group chat. The fear of man lays a snare, and that snare takes many forms. So yeah, I mean, it's easy to dunk on the elites and the experts after, you know, all the stuff with COVID and with central banking and fiat money printing and all that. But there is another kind of danger too, that you are in it for the clicks and the engagement. And I don't know, I've been chewing a lot lately on Bitcoiners telling each other to stay humble and stack sats. And I don't know, how humble are we really? I'm not sure. And you, God has ways of humbling you when you are not. And I don't know. Last couple of days, I've kind of had a heart and a burden to think more and try to help these guys more with like, what really is humility and why is it a blessing and a joy? And I don't know. There's a lot of great self-confidence in the Bitcoin world and in the Bitcoin future, which, you know, I'm confident about it too, but I don't know. I think sometimes you can't just tell yourself that we're all staying humble and not actually be humble.
Yeah, you can be stacking sats and not stay humble. So we definitely want to and need to work on that. All right, here we go, Jim. You got the rest of them. Keep going here.
I was just going to say the probability of hearing somebody say have fun staying poor after they've said stay humble and stack sats is like 100%. So,
Jim, do you have any either book recommendations for a Christian or even a non-Christian Bitcoiner that genuinely wants to understand that principle and understand what you, because you said about like there's blessings that come with humility that are unexpected and maybe you wouldn't guess on the other side. Is there something to study or read or consider that you'd give, or are we waiting for you to write your next essay on it?
Wait for the next essay. Let me think about it.
Let's hear it. Wisdom embodied. Let's go. All right, the next link here. Pete Rizzo, friend of the program, Bitcoin historian, breaking: public gold miner Bluebird just announced they're starting to mine Bitcoin. Peter Schiff quaking in his boots, absolutely mortified. But again, this is totally sane. This is great. Congratulations, Bluebird. You're gonna be the bell of the ball on Twitter's. Again, this is great. Again, this, the fact that they're called Bluebird, and I just think Bitcoin Twitter is going to fully embrace them. Let's go. Selling gold, selling probably some chairs, selling probably some lighted helmets, like all these things they won't need anymore once you're getting out of these mines and getting into Bitcoin mines. Fantastic. What are any other thoughts on this one?
Do you know where they're located?
I do not.
I'd be curious to know which industry has a higher profit margin. Bitcoin mining or gold mining?
I mean, that's a good question. Probably, I mean, obviously it depends on when it's happening, but
I mean, Bitcoin mining is notoriously low profit margin, so.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, again, the biggest miners, now that they're getting all this Wall Street money, they're probably making better margins, I would imagine, but maybe I'm totally willing to be proven wrong. If nobody else has anything to add, we can continue marching
on. I mean, this is kind of a deeper issue that's been gnawing at me for a while, is what do you do as an entrepreneur when you're thinking about starting a new venture that has a lower rate of return than Bitcoin right now? Do you still do it, or do you just
put it all in Bitcoin instead. I mean, I think the future that we're hoping for is that Bitcoin actually stops, like numbers stops going up.
Yeah.
So we can all get back to work. But we're kind of in this weird in-between time where Bitcoin's demonetizing everything. And so the relative rate of return compared to everything else is so much higher that we're all incentivized to basically stop working and just hodl.
Mm.
Doesn't feel super great from a Dominion mandate standpoint.
Yeah. Again, I think this would, I mean, if nobody else has anything, I just think like this, it's not stopping doing something like saving, hodling is doing something. It's actually producing a needed correction given, you know, given where we are. It's like, the prospect of stopping eating in a vacuum sounds like, why would you ever do that? And yet fasting is a thing. And fasting is a thing that actually has tremendous benefits on a number of different levels. And so, again, you can't just look at the stopping producing in a vacuum as if that's the only, as if it's, and try to judge it objectively, quote unquote. It's like that.
No, we're all trying to just push hyper Bitcoinization as fast as possible so we could just get on with our lives. But let's say that takes two more decades.
Sure.
You know, is it still good and right to set up a bakery to like feed your local community, even though it's razor thin margins and arguably you should have just put that money into Bitcoin, you would have made better returns.
Mm.
So yeah. Let's step back a little bit. If you compare proof of work to proof of stake, right? Where proof of work necessarily leads to more innovation on the energy efficiency side, on the mining side, and there's no passive income with your Bitcoin versus Ethereum, proof of stake, and this whole concept that the wealthier you are, the more you have, the more you can rest on your laurels, the more you can just take your passive income without selling your asset. So I would argue that proof of work necessarily promotes work and promotes stewardship and promotes a long time horizon mindset. So, and if you combine that with the Christian worldview and what we would call Protestant work ethic, that's entirely in line with Bitcoin, you're going to work hard and work in a way that you get the highest return on your time and energy, which means you're providing the most value to your community. Then you're going to be frugal with how you spend on yourself. You're going to save and invest. You're going to give generously according to as God has been generous to you. And there is truth. Like there comes a point where you realize, wow, I have accumulated a meaningful amount of wealth. Will I choose to retire? Will I choose to stop working? So then I would go to that Piper sermon from 2003, about not wasting your life. And this the whole question of like, do I want to offer to the Lord my shell collection at the end of my life? Or do I want to offer to him generational faithfulness? Do I want to offer to him that I helped translate the Bible into a tribal language that would never have had access to the scriptures otherwise? Or I funded a rad ministry that helped orange peel the church, right? So there's the fruit and legacy that is actually meaningful that comes after you've built that wealth where now you're freed up with your time and energy to not have to create cash flow, but now you get to serve irregardless of profit motive, which doesn't exist in your working years.
But you're not talking, Jim, about, you're not saying retire. You're just basically saying if the rate of return for my business that I want to start is not better, like for my bakery is not better than Bitcoin, does it make sense to take money and put it into a bakery instead of just keeping it in Bitcoin?
And, well, yeah. Yeah. So I'm separating it out. Obviously, as Christians, we're going to use our time as much as we can to God's glory and to earn money and to fund mission projects and to donate and give tithes and all that kind of stuff. I'm talking about purely from the investor. Yeah. I'm putting my investor hat on now.
Sure.
As an investor, when I'm being asked to consider putting money to work,
yeah,
I have a hard time right now wanting to put my money anywhere other than Bitcoin.
Yeah. And so what I would say is it depends on what is the overarching principle? Like, Bitcoin be damned. Okay. Like, the overarching principle is you love God and you love your neighbors. So if you like weigh the options and determine that your neighborhood where you live doesn't have a good bakery and like doesn't have like there's not other options, and you feel like for somehow, you have like good bakery skills, or you know somebody who does, who like they really feel like this is what they should do, like then maybe I'd consider it. But I would say under normal circumstances, there's like 100 different places where people get, again, with this specific example of like a bakery, like, is this really the most needed thing? Probably not. Well, then I probably wouldn't feel bad, you know, and like I would be content to have that money in Bitcoin. At the same time, if there's other things, like I think the human, like denominating the human returns, like denominating the returns of the humans you can help. Like, if there's something like that, that you're thinking, yeah, actually, if I denominate success in humans, souls, whatever it is, you know.
Yeah. Like, but even in that context, I guess as an investor and a capitalist and an entrepreneur,
sure.
I'm like, if you're asking me to invest in something that is not going to meet the hurdle rate, I'd rather just view it as a ministry or a nonprofit and get a tax write-off for it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, and so again, I think that
like,
makes
okay, we can run like a nonprofit bakery that just, you know, gives bread away, and then at least I can get a tax write-off. But like running the bakery as a for-profit company when I know it's going to lose, it just doesn't make any sense to me.
That's a great, I love this. Like, that's a great way to think about this is like.
Well, and by the way, it's a little bit more complicated whenever like you're the person that's going to be running the bakery and doing the bakery, and you're also the investor. So it just, the lines get more black and white to me whenever there's a different person that's the operator versus the investor.
Yeah. Like, here to be an example, right? Like, if your kids, okay, your kids, you're like, hey, I want to teach my kids how to run a business. And so my kids like making bread. I'm good. You know, like, so let's run this business where in addition to, you know, like really the money is a secondary thing. There's something else that you're trying to get at that's even more scarce. Like, your time with your kids at a certain age is more scarce than even Bitcoin. So I'm willing to exchange whatever the monetary earning potential of the Bitcoin is because my kid's character is more important. Like, something like that, like reasoning like that, I think it actually, would be, that's a lot easier of a situation, to think about, and a lot easier of an exchange to consider making.
But now, what about cash flow for the 20-year-old? So we talked a bunch about this yesterday with the other guys and all of the things stacked up against the younger generation to even get established. So you're living in your mom's basement and you need to go do something and figure something out so that you can even have money to save in Bitcoin. So what's your advice when you're starting kind of at ground zero?
I think you could fall into a trap of trying to find the thing that maximizes your time to money conversion ratio. I mean, just like a great worst case example would be like going and being a prostitute or something. Cause like you can earn the most money for it and stack the most sats, right? But you're selling your body. Like, obviously that's not good. So there's gotta be some cut off in between where it's like, yeah, you're doing something that doesn't destroy your soul.
And there's a drastic example, right? Selling your body for sex. Okay. Here's another example. What about selling your body to work for, Raytheon or like one of these other, like there's a whole bunch of other companies that we could easily have the same conversation about, that you should also be concerned about selling your body to, that again, people just do without even thinking. They go to work for these giant Wall Street corporations that they know are like, there's other things that they could do with their lives, but they're doing that. Again, I'm not saying this is 100% wrong, but like, if your motive is just purely monetary fiat mining, again, that's, you ought to consider that too. Because again, if that was the case, if everyone thought like this, nobody would be a pastor. Nobody would be a teacher. Nobody would be like, nobody would be a missionary. You know, like there are things we can't just think about that, you know, think in that way, even though it is necessary for, I would say, many people to think that way.
I mean, if you're wanting on the ground practical advice about it right now, I'm pretty stumped because of AI. I'm not sure if AI is like as bad as I think it's going to be.
Mm.
Or if it's actually going to be a good thing. I feel like I used to be able to predict 10, 15, 20 years out, and now I'm sort of not really sure what it's going to look like 6 months from now.
Mm.
But I mean, you see news articles all the time. It's like the middle class is being displaced. White collar jobs are going away. It's the worst time to be a new grad in the history of forever. And it's all because of AI. So I don't know. You know, at the same time, it's like I just watched, it was like a 2.5 hour Lex Friedman with Sundar Pichai, the guy that took over Google.
Mm.
And the one hand, it's a really inspiring story. He's like this poor Indian kid that came from nothing, and now he's the CEO of one of the most powerful companies in the world that Jordan loves. And Lex had some pretty interesting questions, but his answers were just mushy. It was like the questions were around like, what do you think is going to happen with the AI, and is it going to be disruptive, and what about people that are worried about losing their jobs? And he was just pretty much like, yeah, you know, this is how it's always been. The buggy whip manufacturers have always been afraid, and it's always worked out, and people are just going to become more productive, and humans are resourceful, and they adapt, and everything will be fine. And, you know, we'll figure out the safety problem later. That I think, you know, Lex called it his P-doom, probability of doom. Lex was at like a 10%, and Sundar wouldn't even give a P-doom. He was just like, it's not even like a important enough question to assign P-doom probability, it's, you know?
Such a lie. Goodness wow. gracious.
But yeah, so.
And he's at the steering wheel. So, I mean, you compare that to Sam Altman, who is like, we're going to have to seriously rethink the social contract in the future AI world. And he's like, wants to totally rethink how human beings interact because they invented AGI, and that's the end all of everything.
Except, at the same time, Sam and Sundar and all these guys, the Anthropic guy, I was watching a Max Tegmark. He's the guy that wrote Life 3.0. He's like one of the top AI safety researchers out there other than Eliezer. And I was watching this last week. And Max was like, they all signed an open letter that was like, we need to deal with the AI safety issue back in 2023. And now it's just ultimate gaslighting. Like the letter never got signed. It never happened. Nobody talks about it.
There's because there's God tier money that they're all making, God tier influence that they're all getting. It's
Well, I in the studio chat I shared two tweets about AI that we could talk about.
Just real quick, Tim, do you have any thoughts on that? Again, you're the rational, like, calm one.
We've seen this movie before, you know, these big movements and developments, and it's like, oh, you know, it's all going to be fine and it all work out. And on this humility theme, let me read you guys something I read this morning. See if you can guess who wrote this.
Mm.
We should be modest and prudent and guard against arrogance and rashness and serve the people heart and soul. And you could, like, you know, hear any of these, you know, mega tech guys of just like, oh no, this is all about people and it's going to be fine. It's all going to work out. And I was just reading that written by one of the worst, most evil people ever to live, Mao Zedong.
Oh my God.
Just got a copy from 1972 of Mao's Little Red Book. And just put them through it today. And, you know, it's got all these like kind of truisms that, you know, it's like, okay, you know, it's like 70% true. A lot of the stuff he's saying, but it's like, there was just unbelievable wickedness committed in the name of this ideology. And it was all in the name of helping people and serving them. So I don't know. I think we should be apprehensive. And I don't know, just this whole theme of, you know, we've been talking on the side about Bitcoiners and generosity and giving towards God's work and giving towards, I don't know. I think it's easy to tell yourself that one day when I'm really wealthy and Bitcoin's gone to the moon, I'm going to be super generous. And that's when I'll decide to start helping people. And I don't know. I keep thinking about Jesus's parable of the rich fool, who in a lot of ways was living this kind of perfect economic life of building bigger barns and maximizing his productivity and his wealth. And he probably was telling himself he was doing it for the good of society and the good of his community. And, you know, he dies and Jesus says, you're a fool and you haven't been rich toward God, which, you know, is probably a way of saying you haven't been generous toward the poor. And if AI does what we're afraid it's going to do, you know, there could be some very poor people, a lot of suffering going on. And if God blesses Bitcoin and Bitcoiners, they're going to need to be generous, even if, you know, in some ways it's it doesn't make sense economically, or it seems wasteful, or it seems like, well, if you would have just waited, then you could have given a lot more in the future. I think at some point you got to kind of pause and listen to yourself, because you can rationalize all kinds of crazy stuff and not deal with the person right in front of you.
Yeah, I think the needle is swinging from our society doesn't even think of saving as a thing that's possible to Bitcoin turns saving into an idol, you know?
Yeah, I think this is definitely the human, this is the natural man. This is how he does things. He just swings, he just pendulum swings from one extreme to the other. And like it's profound to think about one of the fruits of the spirit being self-control and being like, you know, just reasonableness and prudence, you know, which is not swinging to these extremes. It's basically like staying, you know, being able to hold two things at the same time, where we can be generous and we can, you know, work hard, make, you know, acquire resources and be generous to provide for our own families, but also be generous to, you know, to you know, give to gospel work or just normal, normal mercy ministries or, you know, whatever it is. I think like both of these things, you can unspiritually do either of these things. And we don't want to do that. we want to be good stewards who, are thinking carefully about all these things and trying not to fall off either side of the road.
Yeah. So stay humble, stack sats, stay merciful, send sats.
Let's go. That'll preach.
All right, Josh, here's your AI one.
Let's do the, Paul Pastor first, and then let's look at the Marty Bent one. Okay. So this is a college friend of mine. He's a published author, poet, editor, and AI hater. So here he's responding to someone who's bragging about ChatGPT's ability to write well. And the claim is quite amazing. I think you could submit writing of this standard to a magazine and get published. Took 3 seconds. And so here's Paul, who's in the publishing industry. He says, no, it took 3 seconds and the systematic plagiarizing without sound ethic or consent of the labor, experience, and creativity of countless human writers. LLMs are inextricable from colonial extractive logic, and to use them to, quote, write is both tasteless and immoral. So he needs to tell us how he really feels about this. So it's interesting. So Paul's a friend.
Where's the morality lie, though? Does it lie on the people that trained the model or the people that used it?
I think he would say on both. I think he would say, and there is definitely, right, that there are legal cases still open over ChatGPT's use of copyrighted material. And then all its users' use of that copyrighted material to then cheat on other things and like hand it off as their own. So I feel like he's getting at the heart of what does it mean to be a human, and he's saying, right, it's a part of our creativity and the work of our hands and receiving the fruit of our labor. This whole sowing and reaping principle that we talk about in Bitcoin and a lot of what I think the LLMs are using is bypassing like fiat currency that just has the money printer that prints value out of nothing. These LLMs are fiat idea printers. And they just print ideas out of nothing, which is the same, last time or the time before, the whole AI and Bitcoin thing. Bitcoin is digital scarcity. AI is digital abundance, but it's like the money printer, so that everything's value goes to zero because you've just like you've just overwhelmed the world with supply of information, and thus the actual value of that information goes to zero.
So if we're like cavemen and I see you create a fire and then get the idea to go create my own fire, is that the same thing?
So, I mean, you could go the path of talking about copyright law, and I know Jordan has opinions about that. So I don't want to primarily defend the fact that you should be able to copyright and protect an idea. I think there's pros and cons. I'm not an expert on it. I could probably be convinced either way. But passing it off as your own is called plagiarism. And that's clear. It's an issue of pride and humility, right? Be humble. It means don't take credit for what is not yours. Be honest.
So when I get back to my cave and make my fire and then tell my cave wife that I've made a fire, look how cool I am, that's the part that's the wrong part?
So as long as you say, hey, Oshawa showed me how to make a fire, then that like baptizes it. Even though he could be, listen, I could have enriched myself for 1,000 years by being the one who created fire and who is just as the only one who has the rightful ability to use it. Like, this is where, again, we don't have to get into this whole discussion, but I really do think it gets tricky because at the end of the day, you're like, there's a verse that comes to mind. It's like, what do you have that you did not receive? Mm-hmm. So it's like one of the things that just really just has been hitting me over the years is just like, he gives everything, including ideas. And so like nobody can just say, I had this idea. You know, like that didn't come from you, came from other people, came from other places. Now, again, like the specific use of it, like that's one thing. But again, I do think it is tricky.
See, really? Like Mozart writing a symphony didn't have any unique idea? It was all just received?
No, what I'm saying is he received, like his creativity came from somewhere. It came from, like, I'm just saying, like, came from God. So, like, but again, it just comes down to, again, I have a problem with the entire reasoning because it's a similar, you were right, Ash, to point out the money printing thing. Because really what it is, it's like, oh, we're multiplying currency units. It's like, no, you as the central issuer are actually stealing purchasing power from everybody else. And so that is a very similar thing to what's going on here. Again, the issue is the solution to this, just like the opportune thing, which we could talk about, the solution to this is not a technical solution. Like there's no technical solution because the technical ability to steal exists. So that exists. The technical ability to steal, the technical ability to do all kinds of things exists. So what you need is moral constraints and moral norms to say, hey, we're not going to do this. I could do this. I could steal from you. I could club you over the head in your cave and take food from you, but I'm not going to do that. That's not a question of technical restraints. It's a question of moral restraints. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, again, so I agree. I'm sympathetic to what Paul is saying. But so my question is, what is Paul wanting to do about this?
Yeah.
If he's trying to shame them into this, I think this is an effective, I think shame is proper in this.
What are you guys doing about it at your seminary, Tim?
You have to tell us if you're using it, but basically you're not allowed to use it. And it's just, I don't know. I mean, students, there's always been ways to cheat as a seminary student if you're training for ministry. And it's kind of like, okay, well, if we catch you, that's a big problem and there's big consequences to that. But it's also like, man, you're training for ministry. Like if you're going to lie and cheat here, it's like you've got some big problems you've got to deal with God before you go into ministry. But it's also, I mean, so that's part of it. There's kind of that moral issue, but I think there's also the character issue of like, the point is to do the hard work. That's how you learn, is by struggling through writing. You know, writing is a form of thinking. And if you're just going to kind of outsource that to the blob out there and just copy and paste whatever it gives you or lightly tweak it, you have totally shot yourself in the foot and you're learning very little. I mean, I think there are some good things that you can use it for and some helpful things, but it's like, man, I don't know. It's just because something's easy doesn't mean it's good. And I worry for people But yeah, I'm not sure what to do about it. Kind of like what Jordan was saying. I'm not sure you can put the genie back in the bottle at this point. And we got to learn how to develop the self-control to not always take the shortcut and not always do the easy thing that actually could be a lot worse for you.
Well, I think part of the thing, I guess part of the thing you could do is force these large language models to pay somehow for the data that they're using. I mean, this is the other thing. We should have found an article about this, but it talks about the fact that they're not expected to be profitable for like years, like if not like decades. Like they're nowhere, they're super in the hole. And so it's like it's doubtful if they're ever going to actually, you know, like it's going to take them a long time to actually make money. So
I don't think they care about making money. I think Sam Altman just wants to get to AGI as fast as possible. So then humans are irrelevant and economies don't make sense anymore.
So the ends justify the means. Like that's the thing is like to, you know, if you, that's one way of looking at the world. It's a horrible way of looking at the world.
So I still remember when
to approach the world.
Yeah.
It's a what?
It's the Sauron method of approach.
Sauronic. Yeah.
I still remember when Facebook finally monetized and they just inserted ads in between all your like family members' posts and all your friends. Just imagine if your LLM just decided we're going to insert ads, but it's like hidden. It's like, help me find what's the best this and this. And there's actually paid responses within the LLM to push you towards a certain reality. And I feel like that becomes the issue, is when the tools shape us. Every tool you use, you're not just using it in the real world. How it operates, you have to play by its rules. You have to conform your hand to its contours. And so it shapes you. AI, as you prompt it, is shaping you. And AI, as it is creating content through you, it is shaping you. As it's feeding you information, it's shaping you. And so the question is not just what will the AGI do to like rule the world.
If we ever get there,
it's already happening. Like you already get black women founding fathers. It's already happening.
But wait, what is that though? You're saying that's just like erasure of history, or like what are you saying?
No, it's an ad. It's basically the people that are funding Gemini have a certain worldview that get you to believe. They're paying to fund Gemini and at a loss. And so they're getting them to essentially do their reinforcement, you know, fix up at the end where they just change it to, hey, this query results in black women founding fathers. So,
Tim, here's a question for you. Just principally, how do you guys, like, what is the principled argument for distinguishing between Google, like using Google to help you write versus AI? Like how do you guys distinguish
that? Like spell check or something?
Sure. Yeah. Like, I mean,
I don't know. I mean, that's the million-dollar question right now because the line between these things has gotten so blurry.
Yeah.
And so what we're telling students is err on the side of asking the professor what's okay. Is this acceptable or not? I mean, I had a student recently who, you know, has been using Grammarly for years, which typically has just been like, oh, put a comma here, or you forgot the apostrophe. And now it's writing stuff for you. And she didn't quite realize that, I think. And so it's like, man, it's just tricky. And it's just, again, it's like so many other things. You need wisdom. You know, you need this ethereal, mysterious quality of how to walk wisely in God's world. And scripture says it begins with fearing God. And there's not clear-cut answers on so many of these things. And I don't know. So much of what we're doing online, I think, is antithetical to wisdom and encourages foolishness that, you know, you worry about what it means. We have so much power with these tools, but are we good? You know, that's the real question.
Yeah, neighbor love as the motivating principle, I think, is kind of what Paul's talking about. Like, this is... you know, stealing from your neighbor for your own benefit. You know, you haven't asked him, you haven't paid him for it. You haven't, like, you're effectively stealing the product of his work. And that's a big deal. Like, that's going to have, again, the other thing is, like, this is going to have lots of consequences downstream. Like, this isn't just going to stay in a vacuum. This type of thing multiplies. But yeah, there's so much money and so much power to be made by so many people that they're willing to just tell us to shut up when we want to have these conversations.
Mm-hmm. All right, Ash, you want to take it with the LOTR reference here.
Well, yeah, this is, I wanted to end on a positive note, because obviously Marty here in this post is taking a positive view of AI. And so I retweeted it and put the Lord of the Rings quote about this idea that Mr. Frodo, there's something good in the world and it's worth fighting for. And so Marty is saying, hey, it's never been easier to take agency over your own life via tools like Bitcoin and AI. They won't solve all your problems immediately, but if you put in the work, you'll be pleasantly surprised with the results. We're living through a period of insane productivity gains that can be matched with the hardest money that has ever existed. So we've talked a lot about how, hey, Bitcoin and AI, there's certain ways they're opposed to each other. One's libertarian, one's authoritarian, one's like scarce, and one is infinitely kind of fiat printing of ideas. But what does that look like where if you are good and humble and you have hard currency and AI tools, like is that the superhuman potential? Is that possible? I mean, so Barney thinks it is. He just helped Vibe Code with Moses, their rad opportunity cost little app, and that multiplied productivity. How do we hold both? Kind of Ecclesiastes, not be overly righteous and overly wicked, but find some tension in the middle.
Yeah, we need wisdom.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think going back to this book I read recently about Tolkien from a Catholic philosopher, he had this little section where he was talking about how, you know, there's basically two systems of ethics. There's the kind of ethics that is based on the outcome that says, well, what will lead to the most wealth or the most, you know, happy people? Therefore, whatever gets us there must be okay. Or there's, you know, what would be the Christian view of ethics is that there are actual principles to follow regardless of the outcome. You know, there's some things that are just wrong to do no matter what happens. Mm. And there's some things that are good to do, even if, you know, it seems that everything gets wiped out in the end. And I think that can only ultimately be the case if you have a kind and a generous and a wise and a powerful God ultimately ruling over everything. And that is good news that humans are not on their own and that the world is not left for us to figure out on our own. And so he's talking about how in Lord of the Rings, you have this theme of hope, but then you also have kind of a hope that goes deeper than hope. And I just wrote out this quote the other day in my little quote book. This is from somewhere towards the end of The Two Towers. Sam said nothing, and after all, he never had any real hope in the affair from the beginning. But being a cheerful hobbit, he'd had not needed hope, as long as despair could be postponed. But now they were come to the bitter end. But he had stuck to his master all the way. That was what he had chiefly come for, and he would still stick to him. His master would not go to Mordor alone. And so you have this theme throughout the whole series of people doing things that they know are the right thing to do, even though they have no expectation that it's going to work, but they still do it anyways. They don't just give up. And I don't know. I was really challenged by that little line about how you don't need hope when you're really cheerful and, you know, kind of who cares, but it's like when you hit the end of yourself and you have no power left to do it, that's where real hope comes from. And ultimately hope in God to save you from the outside when you really can't do it from the inside.
Hmm. All right, let's jump to Sailor waxing on casting monetary spells as if he's a wizard in the Lord of the Rings, and then coming up with this idea of a God coin thought experiment. Do you guys want me to roll this clip?
Mm.
Sure.
Yes, do it. We can't hear it. Can you hear it?
You can't hear this tab?
Mm-mm. Maybe now. Try it.
We're not hearing the tab.
Nope.
Let me see. Let me do a tab. I think I have to share just a tab.
That's right. I think if you do it, that'll work.
It'd be really great if it was weightless.
Mm-hmm.
How do you make it better? I'm going to cast a spell and allow you to teleport the gold anywhere on Earth. If God said, you know, I'm going to implement a system of 21 million gold coins, but we're going to call them God coins, and I'm going to keep them in a bank in heaven. And I'm going to let you transfer, you know, any amount. I'm going to let you subdivide it by 100 million and we'll call them Satoshis. And I will let you transfer peer-to-peer and pay anybody anytime instantly at the speed of light. And I will keep track of the ledger of who, you know,
in
who owes
a correctable
what.
Way.
I will never cheat you.
Mm-hmm.
And I will do it forever for free. You know, if God offered you that kind of divine bank and you were sitting in Argentina when the currency was collapsing to zero, the Argentine peso went from $1 to the peso to 1,000 pesos to the dollar over 20 years. And it did it 5 times over the century.
Right, right, right.
Or if you saw it happen in Russia, where their currency collapsed. The currency collapsed in Brazil, not 25 years ago. Currency collapsed in Germany a few times. If you read the history of civilization, read Durant. Durant's talking about currencies collapsing in Russia in 16th century.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, the Roman emperor.
It's just substantial lifetime risk.
All right, Tim, go.
I don't know, Michael, you're not far from the kingdom, but be careful that your God coin doesn't become your God. I don't know. I mean, it's like, yeah, we can be really excited that Bitcoin does all these things and is all these things, but I don't know. You're not very far away from starting to just kind of expect it to be God, expecting it to do things that only God can do and to be perfect. And it's not perfect and it's not going to last forever. And I don't know. It's true. I mean, there's a lot of truths there, but yeah, you get a little bit nervous when you start putting so much stock into something. And it's like, it is great, but it's like the greatest things can also become the greatest idols and they can also destroy you the fastest.
I think the other thing to point out is that God does have God did make a currency. God did put his image and likeness on something. Like he did interact with it. He does have a store of, you know, a value. You look at like the tabernacle and the temple, this is where Israel stored their gold. This is where they stored their treasure. And so then the Apostle Paul says to the church, you are the temple. You know, he says to the church in 1 Corinthians, you are the temple of God. And so like we as people, you know, we bear God's image. And so there's a very real sense in which we, you know, people are God's treasure. And so the reason why Bitcoin has value is because it does value human time, human labor, it values it and takes it seriously in ways that fiat currency does not. So the problem, I think that as Tim was mentioning, the real danger is if you start to try to, again, prioritize and value, because you can't have one more highly than the other. You can't serve two masters. You're going to have one, you're going to serve one and hate the other. You can't ultimately have two currencies by which you denominate success in your life. And so at the end of the day, you're either going to use, if people are God's currency in some real sense, you're either going to use people to serve the end of accumulating more Bitcoin, or you're going to use Bitcoin as, you know, in order to serve the purpose of accumulating more people, if you will, you know, whether it's having kids or making disciples, you know, these are real things. And so I think that's kind of what Tim is getting at is, you know, at the end of the day, things will be used in service of other things. And yeah, the danger is just that you see, you know, if you set aside the monetary unit, the denominator that God has established in order to prioritize and talk about the importance and devote your life to currencies, you know, even something that's very good, the consequences of that are going to be not good. For both for you and for all of the other, you know, people around the world.
All right. Next one. Is this from you, Jordan?
Yep. Will Reeves, founder and CEO of Fold. Full disclosure, I hold some Fold stock, just not, you know, not any like prioritized share, just total normal pleb shares. But Bitcoin treasury companies that convert shareholders into customers and customers into shareholders will define the new MNAV era. You need to, as Tim Kotzman, you need to turn your shareholders into customers. This is brilliant. If you scroll down a little bit, I think there's like that first response was also really neat too. There you go. That's actually Patrick Hubbard. Patrick is a pastor. He's a friend as well. Treasury companies with Bitcoin-centric businesses are the sweet spot.
MicroStrategy or Strategy is on a different level. The rest will need a differentiator in profitable Bitcoin businesses that also accumulate responsibly is it. This sets Fold and potentially Naka apart, but time is limited. So again, this is fantastic. I think that, you know, this is, just one of these things just to think about. It's not just enough to be some no-name random company that's accumulating Bitcoin. You know, like if you actually have a service and you're accumulating Bitcoin, then you can have this flywheel effect of these things. You know, again, and this is kind of getting at what we just talked about. Like if you're a company, like why do companies exist? At the end of the day, money. Companies, well, no, and that's the thing, is that they don't. Like they money is a means to an end of actually serving people and serving humanity. And so, you know, legitimate businesses, they're successful by virtue of
effect. By the non-businessman.
What? What?
Do companies really exist for any other reason than to make money?
Yeah. Well, okay, so yes, because there's things that there's limitations to. We put parameters on things that companies are allowed to do to make money, right? So basically, by virtue of putting parameters on them, we're saying to them there's something more important than just making money, or else we would all be starting our own contract killing companies, prostitution firms, all these kind of things. We obviously are saying at some level that there's something more important than just
those things are illegal.
Yes, but why are they illegal? Because we're saying there's something more that, like, we can change laws and declare them not illegal. Like, there's prostitution is legal in places, but in the reason why it's legal is because they're saying, hey, there's something more important. You know, screwing people over, is not a big deal. There's making money is more important. Giving people freedom.
Screwing people over might maximize short-term gains, but in the long run, it minimizes profits overall. So I'm just saying, I'm going to just play the anarcho-capitalist whipping boy here, but
sure.
Isn't the idea is that companies are the for-profit entities and individuals should be the ones that are out there taking their profits from their interests in the for-profit entities and distribute them to the people as they see they have need?
So are you arguing that there shouldn't be any constraints on a company for their ability to make money?
So we're saying, should there be a civil magistrate? Is that the question?
Or just anything. Should there be anything governing what they do to make money? Is money itself a good to be pursued at any cost?
I think the question is in any society that has human beings, should there be a government? Because companies are just collections of human beings.
Mm-hmm.
So as much as it pains me to say it, we probably should have a civil magistrate.
Yes.
That limits the human beings that are involved in those companies and what they can do. Now, aside from that, the point that I'm making is that it doesn't take a government to put a bunch of restrictions on a company to get those people to act out of self-interest in a way that is good for everybody else. Like if I'm basically screwing people over and defrauding them and giving them a single cheeseburger when they order a double cheeseburger, I'm going to eventually go out of business. So that doesn't maximize profits.
Well, here's a question for you. So what if we just said, you know how like some countries have like mandatory military service? What if we just said, hey, we have to find this balance between maximizing capital and providing, you know, like healthy outcomes for society. So we'll allow every citizen to be a prostitute for 2 years. Okay, 2 years. You can maximize your profit earnings during those 2 years. You're taking a little bit of a risk, but listen, we're limiting it because, again, you're able to make lots of money. You're able to establish a foundation for the rest of your life.
Straw man argument.
Yeah, like, no, it's not. Yeah. Like, it's just
a total straw man.
You can't just say something to straw man, then it becomes a straw man.
It is not the most profitable.
Yeah.
And it's so clearly.
You eventually get sick and die. That's what happens.
But Jim, not if you do it for 2 years. Again, that's what I'm saying. Like you're extrapolating this for
plenty of diseases in 2 years.
Sure. But I'm saying, so let's say this is how they do this where prostitution is legal. They make them do testing. They make them use protection. They make them do all these things.
What are we arguing about anymore? I thought we were arguing about companies are for the purpose of making money. I mean, isn't that like the whole definition of a company? It's like you're either for profit, which means you're a company, or you're a nonprofit, which means you're a charity. There's no
What,
Tim? What do you understand what I'm saying about?
I don't understand what we're saying. Like, I think that's what's confused me is, like, we've gotten into this world where, you know, BlackRock ESG requirements, blah, blah, blah. Everybody's posting their gay pride flags as a company and you're like supposed to get back or whatever. And the only reason those companies were doing that was because they perceived that it would help them maximize their profits because they were just currying favor from the people that they thought were in charge and it was going to mean less regulations on them or they were going to get more customers because a majority of their customers believed in that. Obviously, that didn't work out that well for Bud Light. But at the end of the day, all of the decisions, whether or not they were doing good for people, was they were just maximizing profits. That's it.
I'm not sure that that's what they're always doing. I don't know that they're always consciously just, oh, I just want to make profits. I think many of them probably do things not because they think it's going to make them money, but because they think it's the right thing to do.
Yep.
And
maybe like the rank and file employees, but I'm talking about the people that actually have the money and the power in these things.
Yeah, I don't know, even them. I don't think you somehow, once you get powerful and have money, you somehow graduate beyond having deep priorities and loves and God
exactly.
worship and sacrifice for. And for some people, I think it can be something even more than money.
I agree with you that people like maybe abuse their position of power to export their wacko ideas on other people. But, you know, I don't know. In my experience and all the companies that I've started and been involved in, the only thing that mattered was making profit. That was it. Nothing else.
Yeah. But again, my point is making profit is not sufficient. Like if that's your only motivating principle, like you are not a good person. because what I'm saying is, Jim, you're obviously, this is not how you actually functionally live in the world. Like and nobody lives this way in the world. Like everybody
lives that way within his business. Now, when he takes his owner profit out of his business, what does he do with his money? He's generous with it. He cares for others. He loves his neighbor with his money.
But this depends on what your business is doing, like Palantir.
Yeah, actually, let's challenge Jim. Hey, I'm a DoD rep, and we have some people that we need to go bomb.
Where you can make so much more money, Jim.
$1 billion contract to go bomb people. Will you do it? Since all you care about is profit, Jim?
Yeah, obviously, I won't. But I don't need a government to tell me that I'm allowed or not allowed to do that. That's like a moral decision that I make on my own.
Sure, sure. And I would agree with that, broadly speaking. The issue is, like, at the end of the... like. So again, this comes down to like, what is the role of
government? We live in a society where it's totally legal for me to write code that goes and flies missiles through orphanage windows.
Correct. Correct. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
So here he has a moral kind of metric and compass that is different than the legal framework. It's not as broad, right? It's more narrow than the legal framework.
But here's my point. My point is it's like, when I think about being charitable, I don't necessarily think about it in terms of how can I be charitable with my company. What I think about is how do I make more money with my company to get more money into my coffers so that then I can go be charitable just as an individual. That's it.
Yeah. You're just saying that's not what you're actually doing, though. You refuse to do certain things, even though it makes
sense. Yeah. Like, because obviously, like, I have my own mores and my own morality and my own things, right? Like, I don't need the government to tell me, like, the government's telling me, go ahead, write code that puts missiles through orphanage windows. And I'm like, no, I'm not going to do that. I'm good.
Yeah. But that's what we're saying is, like, you're functionally saying there's something more important than making as much money as I possibly could. And so I'm going to choose to limit my earning power in these very specific cases because there's something more central, something more important. There's something more important than doing that.
Yeah. But again, I'm like, so there's like the moral framework that we all work in.
Yeah.
And then there's like decisions between, you know, do I release a plan that costs $60 for nonprofits because I want to give back to nonprofits that are trying to save the world and then charge normal people $120 to fly drones that have the same exact features. And, you know, my point is like, I don't feel morally obligated to like give nonprofits a discount or something.
Yeah. But I mean, I think you do have, and again, some of these Old Testament verses can get abused in really wacky ways in the way they get applied today. But these principles of God commanding the Israelites, don't collect every last little grape in your vineyard, you know, or don't harvest every last little bit of your field. You have to leave some for the poor. to get on their own. And it's like God is specifically putting in kind of guardrails of like, hey, your entire life is not about making the maximum amount of profit. There's something more important. And I think in a narrow kind of economic way, I think, yeah, you could make this argument that like, yeah, businesses should focus on profit. And in a utilitarian way, this is what leads to the most good and the most employment for the most people. But when you zoom out a little bit in terms of like, well, what does it mean to be a person? Like, who is God and what does he put us here to do? You're going to choose to do things that in an economic frame of reference seem foolish and wasteful and unproductive, but are actually good things to do. Robert Breedlove posted something the other day about how the point of civilization is to make people rich. And therefore, you know, Bitcoin is great because it's going to make everyone rich and it's going to lead to civilization. And it's like, okay, that's fine. But I replied and I was like, well, what about making them good? You know, you can be rich, but not good, or you can be rich and extraordinarily unhappy and miserable. And it's like, you can be poor and good and poor and happy. And again, not to romanticize poverty, but
yeah,
the frame of reference, I think sometimes Bitcoiners and libertarians tend to get so focused on the economic arguments about things, and they're right about a lot of things that seem counterintuitive to many people. But I think sometimes you can forget that there is a bigger moral framework here that overrides what exactly is financially or economically rational.
So I actually violently agree with you guys on that as a Christian. The point I was trying to make was in our secular humanist society, the United States is not a Christian country. Mm-hmm. The idea of a for-profit company is to make profit. Like that, this is it's what it is. It's by definition, it's for profit. So now when there's Christians inside of those things, then it starts to become more nuanced, right? But just in general, like if you start a company that is supposed to be making profit, like that's the focus.
It really just, again, and what we're saying is like, it depends on the company. Like it depends on the company. Cause like, again, there's all kinds of, there's all the, even the secular US government still draws all kinds of lines of what you can and can't do because there actually is no such thing as a secular.
There's legal, like in those cases, there's like legal boundaries, right? But then as Christians, we have moral boundaries that may or may not overlap with legal boundaries, right?
But they have plenty of moral boundaries as well. That like, again, like there's a whole bunch of Israel related things that we could talk about. We're like, you can't, like there's like Israel hate speech things where like you can't say something about another country that has nothing to do with our country, at least nominally. And so like there's just 100 examples like this that you could go through. And so I guess the point is like, there really is no secular thing like this. That is it doesn't actually exist. It's everyone has these religious lines that they draw that have nothing to do with, you know, that have nothing to do
when
with
I use the word secular, I just mean non-Christian.
Yeah.
They all have their own religions.
Sure. Yes. But again, but at the end of the day, like everyone has morality. Everyone has lines that they're drawing that are pre-monetary, you know, that they're pre-monetary commitments. So like, that's all I'm saying is everyone has commitments that are more important to them than just making money.
I think this horse is dead.
I was trying to think of something even less obviously harmful. Obviously, you could sit here and say, you know, like the sex example. Like if you're for 2 years, it's not dead yet. But here's an example: feet pics. Okay, what if you just, you know, you just said, hey, every American's allowed to sell feet pics. You don't never show your face. You never know who it is. You're just able to stack tons of money, you know, off of, you know, just indulging people's gross fantasies. Like, listen, you're just making money, right? It's great. Except for no. Like, what is that doing to people? Like, what is that? How is that shaping who we are, what we desire, what we want, and who we are? It's yeah. Even when there's no obvious harm or something, quantifiable harm, there's still limitations.
I mean, you said all the time with like major oil companies like BP making huge investments in renewable energy because they're getting pressure from Greenpeace to, you know, try to give back and not destroy the environment. And so,
but is it because they're getting pressure or is it because they're getting subsidies to do that? Then I would agree with you more. It's they're actually getting money for it.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's complicated, but
yes,
at the end of the day, making profit is not sinful by itself.
No, not at all. I'm not trying to suggest anything of the sort.
Okay. Do we want
to land it or do we want to do one more?
We'll do one more.
Okay. Dealer's choice. Here I come. What are you looking at there? You got, okay. This is a post from some guy named Michael Riani. Who's excited to earn? Yeah, who's excited to earn 4% Bitcoin back on every purchase? Coinbase One Card coming this fall. Spend dollars, stack sats. What do you guys think? You signing up? You on the wait list?
All right. The funny thing is, I literally just put myself on the wait list, and now I want to take myself off the wait list because
on record.
I mean, shout out to Eric Kaysen, friend of the program. Eric's a friend. Eric was one of the first employees at Coinbase and got completely screwed out of his shares and stuff. So I just despise Coinbase, everything they stand for. And again, was just looked at this 4% thing and was like, oh man, that'd be pretty sweet. I'll sign up to hear more later. And again, I just made my own case against myself. So I'm not going to be a hypocrite and support these people. There's some things that are more important than getting 4%. So,
well, love you. You're going to get to 4% if you're holding assets, right?
Correct.
Fartcoin.
I could never. So love you, Eric. I got your back, down with Coinbase forever and always.
All right, Osh, are you signing up?
Well, what was that thing we shared about, like, the one thing that'll get you to come back to Coinbase? Just how easily we'll degen.
He already deleted that message. It's his trademark.
Oh, no. That is not true. It is
still there. I'm going to go back to the Signal chat. It'll say Jordan deleted a message. That's mostly, it's like 50% of the chat is Jordan deleted a message. And then DOD Jim. DOD Jim.
Okay.
That's right.
Looks like, okay, right. Matt Purvis, one of the Island Boys, he says he's on the wait list now. You kind of got him to jump on. So, yes, see if you can find the tweet about, oh yeah, here it is. Jordan, me, there's not a single thing that Coinbase could ever do to get me to return as a customer. Coinbase, 4% back in Bitcoin, me, where do I sign?
That's what I'm saying.
Can you
share? I was confronted with my own inconsistency.
The Signal chat? You want me to say?
No, not that. Don't dox our Signal chat. No, it's the screenshot about how you need to hold assets. Did you guys see that? So, yeah, the scoop is it's up to 4%, up to, and it's based on holding assets, either cash as dollars or other crypto assets. So there's that little circle there. And so what is the opportunity cost? How much, either dollars, you got to be dollar rich to just keep at Coinbase, or you have to be willing to let them custody your and probably rehypothecate your Bitcoin in order to get 4% when you spend the credit card. Like, I don't know. What's that opportunity
cost? This is really about
a hack or of holding fiat?
That's what this is really about. They want you to hold your coin on Coinbase so they can rehypothecate.
Exactly.
Which is exactly what FTX did. They paid up to 7% for holding cash or Bitcoin on their platform. I wonder why.
Gross. Now, again, we'll say this. We don't know that they're rehypothecating. We don't want to cover our rear ends. But again, is it worth it? I'm not going to do it.
Is there any difference between this and holding MicroStrategy?
I don't know. Work that out for us, Jim.
Well, MicroStrategy theoretically custodies its Bitcoin at Coinbase Prime. So if the whole reason that Coinbase is doing this is to make sure that they can custody more Bitcoin, then buying MicroStrategy just enables Sailor to buy more Bitcoin that gets custodied at Coinbase. So in the end, it's turtles all the way down, all the Bitcoin's custody at Coinbase, 6102, Bob's your uncle.
So this is where we get into like actual ethical decision making. Tim, I'm gonna shut up and let you have this one. What do you think?
You have to disclose what you own.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. It's like just these kinds of things are sad because they suck in people who are unaware of the risks and they get wrecked by it. And you hope that people kind of learn from the last time we did this that a lot of these things are way too good to be true. And just be careful and don't go crazy on things you don't totally understand what you're getting into.
Yeah. So what's your number though? If what if it's $1,000? Put $1,000 in Bitcoin on Coinbase and you get 4% return on all your credit card purchases. Is that?
I'd do that.
Yeah. See, so even Tim has a number. He will.
But just profit at all costs, man.
That's right. And that's what I'm saying. So my thing would be, okay, so there's other companies like Fold. I've been on Fold. Listen, we love Will Reeves. Fold, please. We want your credit card, okay? We want to just be able to make a purchase on it, pay it off every month. Like, please. I don't know when it's supposed to come. We want it sooner rather than later. If for no other reason, for the purposes of this conversation, than to have an alternative to Coinbase. I want to support good Bitcoin companies, not companies that are preying upon the basest impulses of gambling that people have. So, I think that would be the thing. Is like, I don't think it's either Coinbase or nothing. If it were Coinbase or nothing, I would rather, you know, choose some other thing. Like, you're going to get 2% back from some other things. But again, if Fold, I don't remember what their number was. Is anybody remember?
I don't know.
I think it's 2%.
It's fiat prizes.
Yeah. If it's 2% and they're like, hey, we're going to demonstrate that we're not rehypothecating, I will do that. I'm happy to take less in order to support somebody who's not rehypothecating. This is why I will buy Bitcoin through River, even if it costs me a little bit more compared to what I could get some other places, because they're choosing not to, because they're choosing not to sell the altcoin casinos. I'm happy to support them, be content with less, and support people who I, you know, think will exist in 20 years.
I need to like,
and people that I want to exist in 20 years.
I need to like frame this and just to remember.
Austin's doing a paid promotion right now.
Yeah. This is my actual BlockFi.
Wearing his eToro shirt, shilling BlockFi.
These are not sponsorships, I promise. But yeah. Things can be too good to be true. Let's just say that.
All right. Should we land it?
Land the plane. Thank you guys for joining us for episode 13. The most contentious episode of To the Unknown Pod by far. This is what we love.
I'm just going to go back to being a ruthless capitalist and profiteering off people. So I'll see you guys later.
He's not buying, what's it called? Not Raytheon. What's the other one?
Palantir.
Lockheed.
Palantir. Don't believe him. If he buys Palantir, you know he's gone full degen. Until then, we know he's got a heart and a soul and he's not willing to sell it. Praise the Lord. We're grateful for you guys. Support us. You can like, subscribe on all of the different platforms. Beyond that, again, go get yourselves a copy of The Orange Umbrella. I've got something in my mouth. The Orange Umbrella. Go find that tou.tgfb.com. You can go grab yourself a copy, multiple copies. Give them out to all of your friends and family. Even if they don't like Bitcoin, covertly orange pill them. We will see you on the next episode of To the Unknown Pod. Thank you, Jim. Thank you, Tim. Thank you, Ash.